What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for July 30th, 2018. On today's episode, we'll discuss what we've been up to at the water cooler. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serretta, and joining me today are Slash Film Managing Editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And Writers Y Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
Let's start off with what we've been doing over this past week. Brad, after Comic-Con, has been over at Slash Film headquarters, and I've been hanging out with him. We'll talk about a bunch about that on this podcast. The first thing I wanted to talk about, though, was we went to an art gallery at IM 8-Bit in L.A. We saw this show called Some Assembly Required, which is basically a show of custom-created action figures from movies and video games, figures that were never actually released. Brad, why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, this so sometimes when I hang out in Los Angeles after Comic-Con, there's some cool things that are happening that I get to check out that I otherwise normally wouldn't, since I don't actually live in Los Angeles. So it was nice to be able to check this out. This was an exhibition put on by artist Dan O'Brown. And like Peter said, he created action figures for movies that don't really have action figures. And he did them in the style of the reaction figures that Funko makes, the very simple throwback kind of action figures that don't really have much articulation and usually come with like one or two little accessories. And he did an assembly of figures that were based on movies and video games. I think there might have been a little bit of TV in there, but I don't recall. But it was a smaller show. But considering the fact that he made these figures by using parts of other action figures and sculpting and painting them himself, it's pretty impressive that he made 40 individual unique action figures. So like they varied from Leon from The Professional to Lucas from The Wizard. They had a version of Jean-Claude Van Damme from Bloodsport where in the package he's actually doing his signature splits. They had Teen Wolf. They had Steve Martin from The Jerk. They had two Dumb and Dumber figures featuring Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels in their blue and orange tuxedos. One of the figures that I wanted was a small one, which was a Folgers coffee can representing the cremated Donnie from The Big Lebowski. As soon as we got down to it at the far end of the gallery, it had just been sold and a little red dot was put on it indicating as such. And so I was not able to purchase it, which was very disappointing to me.
One of my favorite figures was the guy from Blair Witch Project, which just had his figure like facing the wall.
Yeah. And the figure was the actual wall from that shot in the movie where he's stuck in the corner.
Yeah. It was great stuff. All these handcrafted, created with a combination of different like G.I. Joe action figures and stuff like a Frankenstein, and then like puttied up and painted, custom painted. So as you can expect, they were very expensive. I think they ran what, like 80 to 300.
Yeah, most of them were 200. There were a couple of ones that were bigger and a little more involved that were 300, and then like the smaller ones, like the Big Lebowski one I mentioned, were around 80. But yeah, most of them were $200, so pricey, but they're also, you know, one of one, so this it's an extremely unique and collectible item.
Yeah, and the show is on display now at IM 8-Bit Gallery, and I think we're gonna have a post rounding up some of our favorite figures from that show tomorrow on the site, so you can check it out there and find a link to IM 8-Bit from there. Brad, you've been in L.A. What have you been doing?
I always love coming to L.A. and hanging out with you, so it was just enjoyable to be there and hang out with your dogs, Pixel and Gizmo, even though Gizmo every single day seemed to forget who I was and just wanted to bark at me all the time.
He's like, oh my god, there's a new stranger in the house every
yeah,
day.
Exactly. Yeah. And then when I actually left the house, he came to the door. He's like, wait a minute, you're leaving? I just figured out who you were. It's just nice, relaxed. This kind of goes into the what we've been watching segment, but Peter, I'll say this simply because I did it while I was at Peter's house. Peter finally got me to sit down and watch half of the first season of Cobra Kai. And I will say that it's very, very fun. It's definitely a little bit cheesier than I was expecting, and I'm not like over the moon for it like some people are, but it's a very enjoyable series, and the way it evolves Danny and Johnny as characters is very interesting, especially how it incorporates their kids into their lives and their rivalry even as they're older now. It's definitely a fun show, and I think it's worth watching.
I think the thing I love most about that show is it's like a secret way to get people to watch like a Mean Girls like TV show. Like it's really, I mean, it is about them, but half the show is kind of like this high school drama that I think people either aren't expecting but are gonna love. I know you weren't sold on it initially, kind of like me. The first two episodes aren't a strong punch in my mind, but I know the last episode you looked at me and you're like, okay, this is good.
Yeah, I don't remember if it was the fifth or the sixth episode, but right around the middle of the first season is like the show really, I think, gets more confident and finds its footing and really feels like it's a solid, you know, continuation of the Karate Kid story.
Yeah. Over this weekend, I went to a thing called 49 Boxes. It was this event has been held in San Francisco, LA, Las Vegas, and it's very hard to talk about. It's very hard to explain. On the website, it says 49 Boxes is a social story-driven experience where audiences interact with incredible artifacts to solve mysteries and that have been kept secret for more than half a century. This isn't an experience that happens around you. It happens because of you. It's kind of like a escape room, but instead of it being a group of you and four or five of your friends, it's a group of you and maybe another friend and dozens of other people in a room. The room that we experienced this in was a mausoleum. But in huge heat, by the way, the heat was just intense. Basically the premise of this is this does have a magic tie-in, which is what got my interest. It is this old manufacturer of handcrafted magic apparatus and illusions and stuff like that from like the early 19th century. Basically, when he died, he left this mystery for his loved ones. It was these 49 boxes that all when you arrive at this location, all these boxes are laid out on tables. You find a table to sit at randomly, and you just start opening the boxes and opening. Like there's letters in there, there's a story going along with it, and you have to put together things. There's puzzles. And there's a box in the middle that has at least a dozen locks on it. And the goal is to unlock that box and find out what is inside there. There's some magic-y kind of cool things. I can't really explain what we did because I feel like that would ruin the puzzles and the experience. But I will say that we lit a fire, like an actual fire in this mausoleum. And what we saw happen... was so magical on a science level, I'd say, not like a magic level. And it was just so cool, and it was interesting to like just be thrown in it into this kind of situation with so many people that you don't know, and you're trying to, you know, all together come together and solve this problem. I'm not sure if it's, I don't think it's said on the website, but this is the brainchild of two guys that run this company, 42 Entertainment, which you might recognize. They basically were responsible for some of the biggest ARG campaigns in the movie world. So if you remember The Dark Knight, that whole like scavenger hunt, like all those things around The Dark Knight, or Tron Legacy, they were responsible for that. And this is like their side project. And I'm not sure what they're where they're going with this. This seems almost like they're dipping their toes in the water to see if people are interested. And they are, because, you know, the press they've gotten for this is insane. You know, people have basically called it life changing. I would not call it life changing, but it is a fun experience. I would highly recommend it. I'm not sure they have any upcoming shows planned, but you can go to 49boxes.com and add your name to the email list, and they will send you information if and when they do future versions of this 49 Boxes event. I highly recommend it. Jacob, what have you been up to?
Nothing as exciting as that, Peter. My nephew turned 2 years old over the weekend, so I drove to San Antonio, where my family lives, to spend some time with them and celebrate that birthday. And I quickly learned that two-year-olds' birthday parties are completely pointless, because the two-year-old is not aware it's his birthday and is not aware he's getting presents for a special reason.
It's more about the parents.
Yeah, it's really just an excuse for everybody to see each other and hang out and have conversations and catch up. And
Actually, I hate to interrupt you here, but it's almost to me like when you bring toddlers to Disneyland. I go to Disneyland a lot, and I see like toddlers in these, you know, strollers, and it's like these toddlers are not – they're not going to remember any of this. It's all just for the adults.
Yeah, 100%. As someone who's had the same conversation with my mom many times, because she used to take us to Disney World every 3 to 4 years like clockwork, but she waited until we were all tall enough to ride all the rides, because otherwise what was the point, was her words.
But so
we celebrated that. I saw my family, and my mom, she's retired. She's a single mom, Air Force veteran, women's health nurse practitioner. So she worked hard all of her life, and is now enjoying her retirement by transforming her backyard into a destination for her grandchildren, of which she now has three. None of which from me, by the way. And I learned, I once again learned that children terrify me this weekend. But she had a pool installed with a bar, with a fridge, a playground for the kids, a fire pit, fenced off in different areas, a long run for the dogs. It's just, she's pretty much spending all of her time and money out in her backyard, so she tried to make it as, like, relaxing as possible. And we ended the birthday party after the babies went to sleep by watching Jaws in the pool, because she had a TV installed with a special weatherproof cover on it by the pool. And I've seen Jaws so many times that I just thought, oh, I'm just going to sit here with a book and read this book. Everybody else watches Jaws in the pool. And because Jaws is Jaws, I was just sucked into it immediately and just ended up watching Jaws for the 100th time. Even my sister, who's not a movie fan in any way whatsoever, she hates Star Wars. To give you an idea of the kind of person she is, comes to movies. She was like sucked into Jaws as well, and admitted afterward how much she enjoyed it. So even when you're watching Jaws in a backyard in a pool with first timers who've never seen it, that movie holds up. That's a really great movie. In this case, you guys haven't heard that before. Jaws, great movie. New news for everybody.
Whoa, pro tip. Let's move on to HT. HT, what have you been up to?
So I was a little late on the coloring my hair for the summer train, and I just colored my hair purple. And not in kind of in, not really inspired by Laura Dern and Star Wars, but sort of along the same lines. I've been wanting to dye my hair this color for a while, so I was happy to see that Laura Dern had already done that for The Last Jedi. So yeah, I just dyed that, did that on Friday, and I'm liking it a lot. And then the next day, Saturday, I went to a Kesha concert, and the hair color is unrelated to the Kesha concert, but it actually fit in really well because there were a lot of people wearing wigs and glitter everywhere. But it was a fun time. I went there with a couple of my cousins, and they'd gotten a deal on tickets. I wouldn't say I'm a huge Kesha fan, but it was fun to just go to this sort of outdoor concert and sit in the lawn and eat, like, have a picnic and everything while people were dancing around us. So that was my weekend. It was a pretty fun time.
Very cool. Let's move on to what we've been reading. Jacob, you're always reading various things. Every week you have a book in your hand. What have you been reading this week?
Well, in terms of books, I finished the Jack Reacher book I was talking about last week without fail. And spoiler alert, Jack Reacher kills the bad guys. So nothing new on book front, but I've been reading. I'm reading a bunch of articles.
Spoilers, Jacob. Spoilers.
I want to recommend two articles that we can link in the show notes, one of which is published on The Daily Beast, and it was written by Jeff Maish, and it was just published 2 days ago. And its headline, the title of it is "How an Ex-Cop Rigged McDonald's Monopoly Game and Stole Millions." And this is a story of how the guy in charge of security for McDonald's's Monopoly game, which you may remember is like you peel off stickers from cups and food and try to collect all the properties like you would at Monopoly and win cars and tons of money.
Jacob, every year I would be filling out that Monopoly board that they would give you. I'd win like a fry or drink. I would never win crap. Like,
because the guy in charge of security was stealing all the winning pieces, Peter. He was stealing all of them, giving them to third parties who would then sell them to somebody else. Like, here's $1 million piece, but you give me $100,000, and then the money would get kicked back up to this main security guy. And he did this for like 15 years, Peter. He started this entire crime ring built around rigging McDonald's contests, and he made millions of dollars. And the story is amazing. It's like a 45-minute long read, and the amazing kicker, and this isn't a spoiler, is that the reason we don't remember this is because it went to trial on September 10th, 2011. I'm sorry, 2001. September 10th, 2001. So all what should have been like a big crazy story was immediately, you know, lost in, you know, tragedy. So I recommend reading this if you want to know why you spent the entire 90s not winning money from McDonald's. The other article that's another long read and really worth it, I think Brad shared this online as well. It was published over on Wired, and the title, the headline is "A Deadly Hunt for Hidden Treasure Spawns an Online Mystery" by David Kushner. And this is pretty much Into the Wild meets Ready Player One, if you want to make a movie pitch, about this art-dealing millionaire who has a brush with cancer and survives and decides life is too short, buries a fortune in jewels in a treasure chest in the Rocky Mountains, then posts a lengthy poem full of clues on how to find it. And the article tracks the subculture that builds up around this poem, around the search, around all these seasoned wilderness explorers who head out to try to find this hidden treasure, and the non-seasoned people who die trying to find it as well. And it's just this fascinating story. It becomes sort of a true crime story when one father starts to investigate why his son died while searching for the treasure. And it's a really good read. Both of these would make great movies, and they both read like really compelling crime tales, if that's your thing.
Very cool. Yeah, you'll have to add the links in the show notes because I want to check out both of these. Let's move on to what we've been watching. This past week, on Friday, I went to downtown Los Angeles to the Regal Cinema to watch the first screening of The Meg, which is the big killer shark movie starring Jason Statham. And you know, we ran an early buzz article on the site. My tweet was not in there because I did not tweet. I don't know. I thought it was okay. It was fun. It's better than Skyscraper, a similar movie that I think I expected to be the better version. You know, the better one of these two summer movies. In the screening that we saw it at, which was the junket screening. This is the first time I've actually experienced this, where they actually had cameras in the audience, in front of the screen and all throughout the audience, night vision cameras to capture audience reactions that they will probably use in the trailers and marketing. Because one thing I didn't expect of this movie is it's filled with fun jump scares. And that's probably the best thing I can say about this movie. So if you like movies that have jump scares, you know, go see this. The script is maybe the dumbest thing ever written. It seems like every single time they opt for cool or fun over logic. but if you can forgive that, you know, go use your movie pass if that's still in business, or your AMC A-list to go see this movie. And I interviewed director John Turteltaub about it. That interview will run either this week or next sometime on the site, and maybe we'll put the audio up on the podcast feed as well. He is a great interview, and so look for that. But let's move on to Jacob. In addition to Jaws, what else have you been watching?
I saw Mission Impossible Fallout, but we're going to get to that in a second because HD saw it as well. It's great, spoiler alert. But in terms of other things, I watched House, not the 1977 Japanese movie, Houseu, which is really bonkers and great, and not the Fox TV series, but the 1985 Steve Miner horror movie. Horror comedy, I guess, is the right term here, even though I never found it funny. It is definitely crazy. It is not. I didn't find it good, but I was in awe of it the entire time. It's streaming on Shudder, and the story of a man who's on to commit suicide, so moves to a haunted house to finish his next book, and the house manifests all kinds of monsters and demons and ghosts to torment him. And it features extensive flashbacks to his time in the Vietnam War. It features slapstick comedy, features jump scares. It features George Wendt from Cheers in a supporting role. And it stars William Catt from Greatest American Hero as the lead character. And it is, I don't know if Chris, our resident horror movie guru, has seen House, and if he has an opinion on this, because I don't know what to think of it. It feels like it's ahead of its time, and that it's like Evil Dead 2, 2 years before it even came out. But it's also not as funny or as confident or as good. It's just this fever dream of craziness. Chris, have you seen this?
I have, and I've also seen House 2, The Second Story. These aren't what I would call good movies, but they have some fun, like, practical effects in them. Like, you know, just the creatures in the film, like the monsters, the ghosts, or whatever you want to call them, look really cool and disgusting. So that makes these films worth watching. But I would not call these good movies by any stretch.
Yeah, it's streaming, and my wife and I watched it just thinking, what is this? Why was this movie made? It feels like it was just cobbled together in a fever dream. But it's if you like the kind of thing, it's no Demon Wind, but in terms of crazy movies, it is definitely worth watching. But in terms of bad horror movies, we followed up with the first half hour of Day of the Dead Bloodline, the latest movie to use the Day of the Dead name for a direct-to-video piece of crap that has nothing to do with it. And that's streaming on Netflix, and you should avoid it at all costs. It is a terrible, terrible thing, and it made me very sad and depressed, so we turned it off.
And you mentioned that you saw Mission Impossible Fallout, so did HT. HT, were you blown away?
I was blown away. I had a really late screening of Mission Impossible Fallout because I went to see it on opening night. I went to see it at 10 p.m., and I came out at 1 a.m. about 2.5 hours later, just feeling alive. The adrenaline was rushing through me. This movie is just spectacle, heaped upon spectacle. And like everyone else saying before, it's just relentless action and entertainment. And I really like that this film, after the last one, Rogue Nation kind of made moves to establish Ethan Hunt as this godly manifestation of destiny, as Alec Baldwin says so aptly. They kind of try to humanize him more in Fallout, and it's a really interesting sort of turn for that to see kind of we've been seeing like Tom Cruise be like wary and just kind of catching his breath a lot for the past few movies, but here he just looks really tired. He looks just like a rag doll in a lot of these shots where he's just being tossed around, and he's just he keeps getting back up because it's his job, but you can tell he's just kind of like it's kind of losing his step a little bit. And I thought that was a really interesting thing, especially with Mission Impossible Fallout just upping the stakes momentously and all the callbacks too to the last few Mission Impossible movies, including a really fun callback to Mission Impossible 2 with the rock climbing, was really fun. And I enjoyed it so much. It probably is not my favorite Mission Impossible movie. I will say that Ghost Protocol is still my favorite for now, which I know that Jacob is offended by, but I really love Fallout, and I can't wait to see it again once MoviePass lifts up their block on it.
I just want to add one thing that HD said there, because she reflected my thoughts entirely, which is that the reason these movies work is not that Tom Cruise does these amazing stunts, but that he seems really surprised at all times to be surviving them. He doesn't make it look easy. He makes it look like the work they are. Like, there's an extended sequence involving Ethan Hunt in control of a helicopter. He's not quite sure how to control. And even though Tom Cruise, the actor, is in total control of his aircraft, Ethan Hunt is not. So the performance is watching this extremely skilled actor act like he's losing control and struggle with it, and that makes it so exciting.
One of the things I really like that Mission Impossible Fallout does is director and screenwriter Chris McQuarrie cleverly gives Ethan Hunt a weakness of, you know, his own kryptonite, which is, you know, that he cares about these innocent bystanders. And I think that is an interesting way to take this character. And also, the more I've been thinking about this movie, the more I wonder, like, do you think that this movie is an extension of the Christopher Nolan influence on Hollywood? Because we're getting, like, these I'm not saying we're getting a lot of these, but we are getting these blockbusters that feel elevated in a way that they feel so well put together. So, just fantastically created and in, you know, not just like a dumb, fun action movie. They're elevated, but at the core, the story and the logic of it does not really hold up. If you like think about it, like, do you think this is the next evolution of the Chris Nolan influence on Hollywood?
I want to hear from Chris here, because you wrote the spoiler review for Mission Impossible Fallout, and I think you've also written a lot about Christopher Nolan. What do you think about that?
I've seen people making that comparison. I don't know. I mean, there's definitely Dark Knight elements in this. I mean, I guess this is a spoiler, but like the bad guy literally sets himself up to get captured because it's all part of his plan, and really when you start dissecting that plan, it doesn't really make any sense, because I don't know how he was able to do this, because he's been in like custody all these years. But I mean, it's weird, because I personally thought we were getting out of that era where everyone was borrowing from the Dark Knight. Like, after the Dark Knight came out, everyone was jumping on that storytelling method. Even like Skyfall, I think, is the most egregious example, where like beat for beat that movie is pretty much the Dark Knight, but with James Bond. But I don't know. I've seen a lot of people saying that this is like the darkest entry in the franchise, which I don't really think at all. I think Part 3 is much, much darker. Part 3 is a really nasty movie compared to this. But
yeah, I don't think it's capturing the grittiness, but I think there definitely is this kind of like yin-yang of this elevated blockbuster, but in the bottom, the core of it is this kind of like a story that like the motivations just don't hold up the more you think about it. But in the end, both of these movies are great. It's not like it bothers me. So it's not really that big of a criticism. I think everybody that goes sees Mission Impossible Fallout is going to enjoy it. But let's move on to HD. You also saw Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
Yes. Speaking of movies that don't hold up but that I enjoy thoroughly, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again is a fantastic experience and just an all-around entertaining like time at the movies. So I remember watching the first Mamma Mia and not really enjoying it, because I had just come off of seeing the stage version where it had been performed on tour at the Kennedy Center, and I'd seen it there and had such a great time, because it's a very interactive play and one that very much leans into its jukebox musical roots and lets you just kind of sing along and dance to ABBA, which I also have sort of a long connection with, because my mom used to have an ABBA Greatest Hits CD that she would play in her car for a full year. So for a long time, we were just listening to ABBA on repeat. So I was very familiar with all the songs and enjoyed the musical thoroughly, and the movie not as much. But I felt like the first movie was, you know, sort of amateurishly directed and kind of going through the motions and not quite as cinematic as it could have been. But Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, improves on all of that. It's much more cinematic. It's really fun to look at. And I think it's also much more interactive in a way that the first Mamma Mia isn't. I was there with a few of my cousins. We went to see it together and we were just like singing and dancing the entire time. The plot doesn't make sense, but I will say, I thought this was hilarious. It has the exact same plot as Godfather 2. So I can
say, I need you.
Say that Mamma Mia 2 is the Godfather 2 of musicals.
HC, we need you to write an article that has that for a headline. I need to read an explanation, and I don't think people here want to be spoiled.
I will go beat by beat, but just a little hint that it has the exact same plot and exact same structure.
Just to piggyback off that, one of the things that I watched this week for the first time was the first Mamma Mia movie, and I just got to say it was abysmal. I like movie musicals. I like Chicago. I like Once. I like Moulin Rouge. I even like Rock of Ages for the most part. So there's plenty of movie musicals that I really like. This was just dreadful. Like, I felt like this could be used as psychological warfare. Everybody in it is so bad, both singing and acting. And it's part of it feels like an acid fever dream. And it's just, I seriously was so mad. And so, like, I've heard that the second one, like you said, infinitely improves upon the first one and is a lot more fun. So I kind of watched the first one because I feel like I want to go see the second one. And now I'm even more curious to see how they can improve upon it, because I hated it so much.
Yes, it's definitely much better. And a lot of it is thanks to Lily James, who is just luminous in this film as the young Meryl Streep's character. And the fact that Pierce Brosnan doesn't sing, like, he sings like one line, but he barely sings at all, which is great.
I do think that Brad's an instant hardcore version of Mamma Mia, maybe due to him being a straight man, and that's not a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a movie that's like acid in the ears of straight men. I think anybody who's not that may have a more instant liking to it. But I understand what Brad is saying.
There are so many musicals that I like though.
But this is a musical made specifically for non-straight men.
there's a really great story about this movie that when on its premiere night, my friend saw a bunch of people dress up for this movie, and they were all like middle-aged women dressed in like bell bottoms and sequins and glitter, and that's just like the perfect picture of who this audience is.
Okay, let's move on to Ben, who did something spectacular this weekend. Ben, tell us about it.
Yeah, I actually got a chance to see Die Hard at Nakatomi Plaza. So this is one of the coolest press events I've ever been a part of. On Saturday night, Fox hosted a screening of Die Hard in celebration of the 30th anniversary. We've been talking a lot about that on the site. We have a bunch of articles and coverage. Maybe we can link to those in the show notes. But Die Hard has been on my mind for a few weeks now, because I've done a ton of research on the movie and spoke with a lot of different directors about the way that it influenced their filmmaking. And I had got this invite to go see the film on the Fox lot with the Fox Plaza building, which is what they used to sort of stand in for Nakatomi Tower in the movie, with that building sort of looming over this big screen that they erected. And so we watched the movie on top of a parking garage that was on the Fox lot on this big blow up movie theater screen, I guess. And I cut together a video so you guys can see, and I wrote a big article about this, so you can check out this video. And they had like a 1980s cop car there, and they had a limo and a guy dressed up like Argyle, the limo driver in the movie, and he was holding a J. McClane sign and taking pictures with people with a big stuffed teddy bear. They had a food truck there. I mean, it was like a huge thing. Reginald Vell Johnson, who played Al Powell, was there, and Bonnie Bedelia, who played Holly Gennaro, Holly McClane, was also there to introduce the movie. They were pretty low energy, but it was still, you know, cool to see them anyway. It was kind of clear that they were like the only ones who were available to drop by and say hi to the fans. It was a really cool experience. I mean, just being able to sit there and watch this iconic movie with this iconic location that's like personally my favorite building in all of Los Angeles. It was like a dream come true. And then, you know, on top of all that, so that was Saturday night. But earlier in the day on Saturday, a handful of journalists were invited to go take a tour of the Fox Plaza building. So we actually got to go inside and basically get a guided tour of like a ton of the filming locations that they used inside the building, because the skyscraper itself was unfinished at the time of production. So it allowed them to shoot all over the building and make it seem like it's a, you know, it was a real building in the movie. So we got to go check out a ton of different spots. I took a ton of pictures. They didn't let us take video during this section, but I have a bunch of photos and like side-by-side comparisons and stuff with what it looks like now versus what it looked like then. And a lot of it has not changed at all. There's like even down to like the rivets in the elevators that form this crisscross X pattern are exactly the same now as they were in 1988. They really went all out during this tour, too. There were like shards of plastic that were meant to be broken glass and like fake bloody footprints on the floor and in the bathroom at certain points. And they took us down into the loading dock area, and they had props from the movie on display. And they had this photo op where you were able to go into a vent with a lighter and take a picture like you're trapped in a vent like John McClane. So yeah, I would just highly encourage any diehard fans out there to check out this article that I wrote, because there's a ton of photos. They let us go on the roof of the building, for God's sake. I was very surprised that they took us up there, because it seems kind of dangerous, but it was amazing. I loved it. And you know, being a huge diehard fan, it was a dream come true.
I am so jealous. I was busy doing an interview downtown while this was happening. The closest I've gotten to this is I saw, I think, the premiere of the last Die Hard movie, the horrible one, was that Live Free or Die Hard?
Yes.
On the
or Fox... wait, no, A Good Day to Die
oh,
Hard.
Oh, Good Day to Die Hard. I saw that on the Fox lot. They unveiled like this mural of Bruce climbing through the vents on the side of the soundstage. And then the party was in one of the high floors on the Fox Plaza building, the Nakatomi building. That was cool at the time. But this sounds like it was next level cool. And I am so bummed to have missed this. But people can live this vicariously through you, your videos and photos and words on slashfilm.com. So check that out. Brad, in addition to Mamma Mia and Cobra Kai, what have you been watching?
On my way back from Los Angeles, on my American Airlines flight, I had access to a bunch of movies on the entertainment system in the seat in front of me. So I watched Love, Simon, which I didn't see when it was in theaters, and seemed like it would be a good movie to watch on the plane. And I really enjoyed it. It's super charming. It's really nice to see just a normal romantic comedy focusing on a kid who happens to be gay in high school and like comes out to his friends and family. And, you know, it's not made to be this innovative, groundbreaking movie. It's very much a typical romantic comedy focusing on, you know, Nick Robinson as a, you know, this teen kid who happens to be gay and has this ongoing like anonymous pen pal situation with another kid who has anonymously come out on this like basically gossip website that the school uses. And so it was, yeah, I just really enjoyed the hell out of it. Definitely a little cheesy, a little cliche, but I think that's what makes it that much more endearing, you know, this specifically because, you know, it's just not the typical boy meets girl kind of romance. And it was, I just liked it a lot.
And you also watched an 80s cult classic, right?
I did. So my friend Ben recently had his birthday, and for his party, he decided to have a bunch of us over to like have some barbecue, just hang out and have drinks. And then he set up a projector and screen in the backyard and wanted to watch Gleaming the Cube, which I had never seen before. He likes it for being one of those, you know, typical 80s movies that tried to combine, you know, the popularity of extreme sports with danger and intrigue. And this one stars Christian Slater, and it's exactly what I expected it to be. So silly in its incorporation of, you know, this sort of punk lifestyle and skateboarding and BMX kind of thing. Tony Hawk is even in it, and he has like one of the worst haircuts ever. And it's just, yeah, it was so fun to watch. Whenever we watch movies like this, because we've done this a couple times before with Rad and I forget what else, but it kind of turns into a little bit of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 scenario where we're all kind of cracking jokes and just having a good time because the movie is just that silly. So yeah, it was definitely a fun experience watching that movie for the first time.
Has Paul Scheer done this movie on How Did This Get Made podcast?
I don't think so, because it's one of those movies like Rad where it's difficult to get on home video because I don't think it had an official DVD release.
Well, he should definitely at some point get to this, because that movie was insane. Chris, you watched The Prestige on Hulu?
Yeah. Have you never heard of Hulu, Peter? The way you said it at the end there was like,
oh no. It's like I feel like a Christopher Nolan movie requires, like, you know, 4K Blu-ray or something. And like,
no, Peter, Hulu is how Christopher Nolan intended it to be seen on your phone.
I also find it strange that in the show notes you wrote that you saw it on Hulu. Like, there was like some point to the fact that you watched it on Hulu.
Well, I'm trying to help anyone out who wants to see it.
Okay.
So I haven't seen The Prestige in a long time. And this is my favorite time of the year because it's Orange is the New Black weekend. And when that happens, my wife watches the show and I do not, because I don't care for the show. So when that happens, my wife goes off on her own, watches. She basically binges the whole season and I get to watch whatever the hell I want. So I was just flipping through Hulu looking for something random to watch, and I saw this was now streaming on there, and I haven't seen it in a long time. So I said, what the hell? And this isn't groundbreaking or anything like that, but that movie holds up, and I really think that is Christopher Nolan's best movie. I mean, I like practically all of his films, but I think that's probably his most compelling, his most interesting film. It's, everyone in it is just really good. And I don't know, again, I know this isn't like groundbreaking news here, but like I said, I haven't seen this probably in like 5 or 6 years. So rewatching it again, I was just really impressed at how well it still holds up.
And I just want to pipe in really quickly and say that you're absolutely right. This movie owns, and it is 100% Christopher Nolan's best movie.
Me, I don't know. Dark Knight I really like, but I will say that this movie is the movie I think that holds up the most with rewatchability. You actually gain more, I think, from rewatching this, even over like something like Memento, where you'd think you'd gain more with rewatchability and you actually don't. I love The Prestige. I have two posters on my office wall. Actually, one thing that wasn't in the show notes that I wanted to bring up to you guys, I wanted to bring up I'm trying to get rid of things. Like I talked, I think last week about OfferUp, this app that allows you to get rid of things. I'm trying to get rid of some board games and stuff. And in my kitchen, I have a small kitchen in our condo unit, and one of the drawers is dedicated to my Blu-ray collection. I got rid of all my DVDs. I have my Blu-rays. They're in sleeves, like a little sleeves with the covers and stuff. And I probably have like 100, 200 Blu-rays. I don't know. I've never really counted. I'm guessing like somewhere between 100 and 200 Blu-rays. But I never watch them. You know, I never go over and grab a disc and go to the, you know, my PlayStation and put it in and watch it. Like, I'm always, you know, on a streaming service or on iTunes or whatnot. Recently, I think in the last 6 months, we talked about it on the podcast. Basically, this app was created called Movies Anywhere, which connects most of the movies from most of the big movie studios, so that if you bought something on Amazon, it's in your iTunes. If you bought something on Vudu, it's in your Amazon. You know, it's all connected. And this has been getting me to think about Vudu offers this system where on their website and on your Vudu account, you can scan your DVD or Blu-ray, and for $2, basically unlock the digital version of that movie in Vudu. And because it's in Vudu, it gets unlocked in iTunes and all these, you know, other devices as well. I've been thinking about doing that to my disc collection, to just get everything all digital and get rid of the discs. But then it occurred to me that, you know, that's going to cost me $300, $400 to to digitize all these discs. Is it even worth $2 a movie for me to do this? So I wanted to ask you guys, like, is it worth it? Like, I just, most of the time I go to streaming platforms anyways. Like, I don't go to my movie library, even my digital movie library. I don't go searching for a movie to watch. Do you guys have any advice?
You should definitely do this, because eventually the streaming services will be so splintered and the rights will be so scattered that you have to pay for every service to find what you want to watch. And having your backlog of favorite movies is going to be very important in the years ahead. That's my 2 cents.
But Jacob, I'm going to be paying for all those services.
Well, in 10 years, when there's 40 services, Peter, you'll be paying for all of them. You'll be paying for maybe 10 of them.
Chris, you're the streaming guy. Like, am I nuts for even considering not paying the $2 to digitize all my movies before I get rid of them?
I don't know, because, you know, even though, you know, I cover a lot of streaming stuff for the site, I'm also a very big physical media guy. So I have thousands of Blu-rays and DVDs. And, you know, while every once in a while I'll get rid of some of them, I can't imagine, like, getting rid of all of them. That's like blasphemy to me, because, you know, a lot of stuff hasn't been digitized yet. There's a lot of movies. You know, I know in this day and age, it seems like everything is streaming, but there are a countless number of films that have yet to be transferred over to any streaming service. And, you know, just the thought of not having access to that gives me the cold sweats. So I wouldn't
get rid of anything that isn't available, like Almost Famous, the director's cut, I guess it's called Untitled. I don't think it's available on iTunes, so I wouldn't get rid of that disc. But I don't know.
It strikes me as the way that Jacob uses his physical library, Peter. I think you should keep those discs and just, you know, put them in a drawer or something. So on the off chance that you need it for a reference point or something like that, you can just pull it down and you'll have it. I mean, even if you don't watch it regularly and work it into your rotation, I feel like there's, you know, it would probably feel good to just know that, you know, even if the cloud exploded, you would still have the physical version right there.
See, I think the problem is my condo has a lot of space, but it has a very little amount of storage space, and especially a very little amount of storage space in the kitchen. And we're reaching the maximum threshold of a kitchen, you know, utensil, you know, in tool space.
At my parents' old house, they had this ottoman in the living room that folded, that opened up, and it had like, it was like a storage thing inside there, and we had a lot of my parents' Blu-ray and DVD collection inside there. So maybe you could look into something like that, you know, a piece of furniture that also doubles as a piece of storage, I guess.
I knew it was going to come to you and you were going to have the wise suggestion out of this group. So it essentially, the idea is to find a different place to store these discs.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, let's move on.
The Prestige is good, right, guys? The Prestige.
Yes. Yes, I love The Prestige. If anybody listening to this has not seen The Prestige, go out, watch it again.
On Hulu.
Yeah, on Hulu.
See, that's why I said it.
Okay, let's move on to what we've been eating. When Brad was here, I went with him to that I Am 8-Bit Gallery, and we also ate at Boo's Cheesesteaks, which I've had before, in this place called Cineholic. But I will let Brad talk about it because he's our, you know, resident food expert. Brad, tell us about it.
Yeah, so whenever I'm in LA and hanging out, I always like to try new places I've never been before. Whenever we're working from your place, if we get food from Postmates or whatever, we usually try and find something really good. Like one time we had this amazing, we had stuff from this poutine place delivered. They had tons of different kinds of poutine, and we got this like bacon cheeseburger poutine that was freaking amazing. So this time we decided, before we went to the gallery, we went to this place called Boo's Cheesesteaks, which apparently Peter's girlfriend really liked, and Peter had been there before, so he had suggested it as a good place to stop, and it was so delicious, like easily one of the best cheesesteaks that I've ever had. I get mine with Wiz. Chris, as a Philadelphia person, I'm not sure how you feel about that. But it was fantastic. It also came with, they had these special kind of fries they called pizza fries, where they put mozzarella cheese and chopped up bits of pepperoni on them that were freaking amazing. So yeah, it was just really good cheesesteak, good fries, and I was glad to stop there. Chris, do you need to yell at me?
No, it's fine. Wiz is fine. It's all right. I'll allow it.
No, I thought I saw something else coming, but it's good we didn't get into that. My friend Dan, who is from Philly, says this is the best.
I wasn't done yet. But yeah, we're going to get into this because Peter ordered his cheesesteak without any cheese.
Peter.
He got meat and onions on bread.
No, it was meat, onions, and mushrooms, Brad.
Mushrooms. Okay, yeah. But so he got a cheesesteak. Sans the cheese.
Listen, I don't love melted cheese on top of everything I eat.
But this combined with the Bagelgate situation, I just don't know what to do with you.
Okay, guys, tell me how I'm wrong.
New slash from poll. Does Peter have bad taste?
I know for a fact that like people will... This is one that everybody's going to agree that I'm wrong. I totally get that. The bagel thing seems totally reasonable to me, to eat a bagel without spread if need be.
But... I mean, Peter, I prefer hamburgers to cheeseburgers, so I kind of see where you're coming from there. Yeah.
See, I also prefer hamburgers to cheeseburgers.
But
it's in the name. It's in the name of the food product.
Yeah, but I mean, for the case of a Philly cheesesteak or any sort of cheesesteak sandwich, I mean, you got to put cheese on there, Peter. I don't know. I can't go all the way down this dark tunnel with you.
Okay.
Just pretend you're lactose intolerant, Peter.
I mean, that's what I do. There's actually places in LA that will not modify like in order. Like, there's this place that is great for hamburgers, and they will not modify, like, you take any modifications whatsoever. But every time I go there, I'm like, I'm lactose intolerant, and they will take the cheese off the hamburger for me. Anyways, I have to lie to not get the cheese melted on my sandwiches, and I'm sure I'm going to hear from a lot of people over this. Guys, I know I'm the nutso on this one, okay? In the bagel gate, I think I'm part of the norm. But this one, I totally get it. You don't have to tweet at me. You don't have to email me. I get it, okay? It's fine.
Oh, you're getting tweets, Peter. You're getting
you're
tweets.
You're getting tweets.
Okay, Brad, talk about Cineholic.
Yeah, so after we went to the gala thing, we decided to get a little bit of dessert. We found out there was this place literally across the street called Cineholic where you order a cinnamon roll with frosting on it, but they have all these different options for, like, customizing what you want on your cinnamon roll, where you can get, like, cookie dough on top of it, or, like, Oreo crumbles, or pieces of candy bar, or, like they have different, like, already established, like, customized flavors. Like, they have one with, like, a marshmallow-flavored frosting with graham cracker crumbles, and they have all different kinds of frosting, too. Like, cream cheese is usually the normal cinnamon bun frosting, but they have a bunch of flavored ones, like strawberry and apple and all that kind of stuff. And so it was so good. Like, they get them out to you, and they're warm, and the toppings are delicious. And it's like, you know, Cinnabon on steroids, basically.
It was insane. It was like I don't know. I felt so gross after eating, and not because it was gross, it was just like, do I really need you know, cookie dough on top of my cinnamon roll? I mean, I do, but I don't need the cheese, but I need the cookie dough. Okay, let's move on to Jacob. You fell off the wagon.
Yes, for years I've avoided eating Doritos because they're the worst chip. And I'm aware of this. I'm aware that Doritos are the worst chip and that Cooler Ranch is the worst bad chip of them all. And yet, after years of avoiding Doritos and years of staying strong and not eating those foul things, I bought a bag of Cooler Ranch Doritos and I ate them. And I feel like a war criminal. I should be on trial. This is the worst thing I've ever done.
Why are Doritos the worst chip?
They're sharp and pointy and not and the flavors aren't that good. And they get stale really quickly. And the whole extreme advertising makes me feel like I'm a 12-year-old, like sitting there on the playground with a bad sandwich, like trying to eke out some sort of semblance of my life.
Have you ever had the taco-flavored Doritos? Because I think those are the best ones.
Oh, Brad. No. Let's just move on before I feel too much more about this.
You know, a little bit of trivia here. Do you know that the idea for Doritos, as urban legend has it, actually originated at Disneyland. That there was someone from Frito-Lay company was at Disneyland, and there's this Mexican restaurant over in near Adventureland, and basically they had tortilla chips. They like put some, you know, cheese, what do you call that, like powder or something,
yeah,
on, sure. And they tried it, and he brought that back to Frito-Lay's, and they created the Doritos.
All right, so forget Song of the South. That's Walt's greatest shame.
Jeez. Okay, Brad, you also found chocolate peanut butter pie Oreos. Are they worth it?
Now that I'm back in the homestead, I'm back on the search for all the unique flavor things. And chocolate peanut butter pie Oreos finally made their way to Walmart. They are indeed worth it. One of my favorite Oreos is the s'mores one because it's a graham cookie with the chocolate marshmallow cream in the middle. And this is a similar thing where they created a graham cookie when they put the chocolate and peanut butter in the middle. So they've done a chocolate peanut butter Oreo before. It was basically a Reese's peanut butter cup Oreo. That's how they branded it. And this one has the filling is basically the same as that, but I think that it's enhanced and made better by the graham cookie. It doesn't taste exactly, you know, like a chocolate peanut butter pie, 'cause it's not as creamy, but I like the blend of the graham with the chocolate and peanut butter cream.
Well, very cool. Let's get to our last and final thing and what we've been playing. Brad, you're obsessed with like Pokemon Go and Jurassic World Alive. They've recently updated the app. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Pokemon Go had a big update recently that added friends and all that jazz. And even though Jurassic World has only been around for a little bit now, I think it's been about a month and a half or 2 months, they recently did a big update because they've had some problems with some bots that were like in the battle area, and like people have been using spoofing, which is where like they fake their location to like always track down like the rarer dinosaurs and that kind of thing. And so there are a lot of cheaters that were at the top of the leaderboards and, you know, basically had super powerful creatures in, you know, their possession and using them in the battles. But now I guess they figured out a way to do away with that. They're also introducing new things that are basically like the Pokemon raid battles. But in this game, they're going to have these little tournaments that players can play in. And there'll be like special rewards you get within the game itself. They changed the map a little bit, so it's a little bit more sophisticated. They migrated like which dinosaurs pop up and when. They've created a little bit more of an abundance for the rare and epic dinosaurs so that people can get a hold of them a little bit easier. It's all welcome changes, and I think it makes the game definitely better than it was when it launched. So if you haven't played it yet and you've been maybe a little bit interested, now I think is the time to check it out and download Jurassic World Alive.
You can find links to that and more in our show notes. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send us your feedback, questions, comments, concerns to peter@slashfilm.com. And please go rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Hey, Peter, remember how at Comic-Con you brought up the fact that I once broke out a very bad insult book on the podcast and insulted everyone, and you said I should bring it back on the podcast? Do you remember the conversation, Peter?
I do. I mean, the podcast is over, Jacob.
But I have the book in my hands right now, and I'm ready to insult every single person on this podcast using the expert witticisms of this book.
Okay.
For the record, this is the gargantuan book of insult, offense, and effrontery. I currently have it open to the failures chapter. So you're all going to be insulted as the failures that you are. Who wants to go first?
Me, Ben.
Okay, Ben. A pickpocket once tried to snatch some money from your pocket, but all he got was practice.
is there any jokes about cheese on Philly cheesesteak sandwiches?
No, Peter, but we heard you're selling all your furniture for a living, your own.
Wait, I don't
wait,
know.
What?
You're selling furniture for a living, your own.
Oh, now
yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
Because you're desperate, I guess.
Oh,
so bad.
That's a really bad one.
Oh, speaking of bad, Ben, I hear that you have an itch to succeed, but you get loused up thinking about scratching it.
Okay, all right.
Wait, you haven't had HT have one yet.
Oh, HT and Chris, I'm saving you for last. HT, you've been waiting so long for your ship to come in, your pier has collapsed.
Oh, jeez. I didn't get one yet.
Oh, Brad. Oh, yeah, because Brad and Chris both need one. Well, Brad, here, at 20, you knew nothing. At 40, you've done nothing. At 60, you'll have nothing.
Wait, he's not... Man. Well,
no, yeah. But I can look forward to that, though.
Yeah. And finally, Chris, anytime you find him with his ear to the ground, it's just because he's looking for a contact lens.
That's not an insult.
I'm not sure this is a good idea.
Jacob, how did this book get published? I have so many questions.
The same as how Bigfoot erotica got published on Amazon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.